This is Dolores Cannon. I'm finally back from Europe and Asia, and I'll be reporting on that later in the month. But right now, we're broadcasting from the UFO conference in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. This is the 18th year that this conference has been going on. I've been involved with it since the very beginning. And my guest today, I believe, has been involved with it almost the whole 18
years. Since 1947.
47. You mean with this conference here?
Oh, yeah. No,
this conference, it's been 18 years. Okay, so I have asked one of the speakers, who's also a longtime friend of mine, if he will be our guest today. So the guest is Wendell Stevens, and he's a longtime pioneer in the UFO field. And he has had a lot of experience with this, and I believe you're best known for your UFO picture collection, aren't
yes,
you?
Yes, that's right. I have over 4,500 actual pictures of UFOs flying objects.
Where do these pictures come from?
Well, when I was collecting such material for the Air Force, I was never allowed to keep anything.
Uh-huh.
And so I started watching for reports in the magazines and newspapers, and when I would clip one out, I'd pursue it, go look for the experiencer,
uh-huh,
and talk to him about what happened and get his information, and then try to buy a copy of the picture. And I often got them given to me. And after I had several dozen pictures, it was easy. Now I had material to trade with others for what they had, and then I just kept trading up and trading up.
Uh-huh. Well, what about fakes? A lot of people probably try to give you pictures that weren't real.
Oh, yeah. You have to learn how to test them first. When I first started, the testing was pretty primitive. We only had photogrammetric testing, which meant examining it with microscope.
No computers in those days.
We had to examine with microscopes and try to determine from the batch patterns and the grain texture. You know, every film, batch of film has a peculiar grain that is recorded in a catalog of grain patterns.
Okay.
And if you look at any particular grain, or if you send it to Kodak, they'll match it with the patterns in the book and tell you exactly what months that film was manufactured and when it was shipped and things like that.
So that way you can date the film.
Yeah, you can date the film that was used to take the picture.
But what about
that
people,
was primitive, huh?
What about people just manufacturing the actual UFO that it's not real?
No, all you can tell is with photogrammetric testing, all you can tell is that the image is either real or it's doctored. If it's a double exposure or a paste up or a reflected image or something like that, there are ways to test for each of those in photogrammetric testing.
So you have had cases of that?
Yes, we had cases of fakes and frauds, but they're pretty easy now with computers. They're real easy to detect.
Oh yeah, I think it'd be really hard to detect now which is a fake or not, because the computers can do everything.
They can virtually everything, yes.
Okay.
But there are ways to beat that too.
Okay. Well, Wendell, let's give your background first. You've been in this field a long time, haven't you?
Yeah, when I came back from World War II, I was reassigned back to Wright Air Development Center at Dayton, Ohio, Wright Field,
uh-huh,
as a test pilot, and I was working in the Flight Test Division, which is a branch of the Foreign Technology Division of the Air Technical Intelligence Center.
Okay.
And we were testing, running test programs on our own new innovative aircraft, but we were also testing captured enemy aircraft that were sent back from Germany and Japan for us to try to study their characteristics and match them against ours, hoping to improve ours to defeat potential advantages that the others had.
And so they did have advantages. They had things that were better than ours in certain parts.
Yeah, we were always in the Air Force. I was always told that the enemy aircraft were inferior to ours. Don't worry about them because it's shoddy workmanship. The engines don't have the full power. They had a lot of failures and everything else. And when we tested their aircraft at the end of the war, we found out that wasn't true at all. Some of them were much better than ours. The Focke-Wulf, for instance, was a better made airplane. It had better performance characteristics. It could defeat ours in almost every aspect of combat, of fighter operations. And the Japanese also had good aircraft.
I remember during the war, it was always propaganda.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of it was. We had to be the very best. But now we're beginning to find out that we didn't have it all.
That's right. We were not the best, and we only won because we we had numbers in our favor. We had more present at the time.
Okay. But anyway, you were involved with the testing of the aircraft.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So another interesting thing is, all pilots don't fly all the time, so we had to all have additional duties.
Uh-huh.
My additional duty was in the Air Technical Intelligence Center, where I had a desk and a bunch of translators that were translating the captured documents from the enemy countries that were being shipped back by the Liberty ship load, and they were coming into Wright Field by the train load and semi-van load. Our practice was when our troops overran a city, intelligence trucks would back their trucks up to every manufacturing plant and operation in the city, carry off all the records. They were all loaded in our trucks and taken to collection centers in Europe and then shipped back to the States here.
Wasn't a lot of that destroyed during the war with the bombing?
Well, a lot of it was, but whatever survived was brought here. So we left the country, the host country, or the former enemy country, with very little information in their files. So at the Air Technical Intelligence Center, I had a team of translators that were going through these documents one by one, and there were tens of thousands of them, looking for, we had save lists from the government and save lists from our aircraft aerotechnical industries, and we were working against all of these save lists.
This looking, means those were more important?
These were more important subjects to look for, and if, as we were reading the documents with our translators, if it wasn't on any save list, it was sent to a shredder and shredded and burned.
So how do you know what might have been important down the road?
Well, we didn't. And a good example is, one time a map came across my desk in that operation, and this map was a geographical map of Greater Germany, and on that map were 9 Saturn-shaped symbols stamped on, like with a rubber stamp, in 9 positions in Greater Germany, which included some of Poland and Czechoslovakia and some of the others. And it was not on any save list. The little Saturn-shaped symbol stamped on it didn't mean a thing to us at the time.
Mm-hmm.
UFOs weren't even being reported then as such.
Oh, yeah, they were foo fighters and things like that.
Oh, spirit phenomena, too.
Very
so
little was out there.
Because it didn't fit any of the save lists, I rejected it, sent it to the shredder, and it was shredded and burned. And I had no idea what it was, but there was boxes of documents with it. Of course, that was all shredded and burned, too. None of that was on the save list. And then, many years later, I encountered a book that was written by a German aerotechnical engineer, a refugee in Canada, called The Nazi UFOs, by Mattern and Friedrich. And in that book was a copy of the same map that I had seen with the same 9 symbols on it, but this was a battle map with the array of the forces shown on the map.
Yeah.
But the symbols were all there, and I recognized that it looked pretty much like the map that I had shredded years before that.
Did this explain what those symbols meant?
Well, yeah. No. In the book, in the Matter of Frederick book, yes. Those were Kugelblitz bases. The Kugelblitz was the German V-7 weapons research program, weapons development program, that was the flying disc.
Well, the V-7s were the rockets. V8?
That was V1, V2, and
The rockets that were shot over.
Those were V1 and V2 and up to V4. We knew we had save lists for V1, V2, up to V4. We didn't know that they went beyond that at the time. The discs were V7, and I don't know whether there were other V programs after that or not, but
that's the only ones I ever heard about was the rockets.
Yeah, that's 1 and 2. So, we shredded, evidently, and with hindsight now, I think we shredded a lot of boxes of technical material on the German flying disc program.
Of course, nobody was into UFOs then either.
Yeah, and we didn't have flying saucers, didn't have UFOs, we didn't have a term for it or anything else, and all went to the shredder. So when I started research many years later, right, I discovered that there were such bases and that the Germans had a well-managed and closely controlled program that was controlled entirely within the Nazi hierarchy of the German armed forces. They discovered it, and they kept it internally in a department they called the Entwicklungsstelle SSE4. And they controlled all the V-7 weapons research development projects. There were these 9 bases. So I think we destroyed a lot of the evidence that we would like to have today.
But how are you going to know there was so much?
We didn't even suspect it at the time that we destroyed it. But then I have to wonder, how much more did we destroy that might be of great value, and we didn't know it at the time, so it went to the shredder and was burned.
Well, we were talking before we started about the research I've done with the atomic bomb and my books on that, and that I found that the Germans were working on atomic weapons too, and you said you agreed with that.
Oh yes, in the research that I did trying to find out more about the V7 weapons development program, it turned out that the Nazi Anschluss-Langsfeld SSE4 also had an atomic bomb development project going. And they had succeeded in manufacturing and testing atomic bombs, including the first hydrogen bomb, and which they tested in a former German colony in Africa, by the way.
Oh, that's where they tested it.
That's where they tested it. And they had, at the time that Germany collapsed, we found two German weapons, bombs, in underground facilities in the Harz Mountains, where the community was building the bombs is entirely isolated from the rest of from the outside world.
See, this sounds very much like the information I've got. And, you know, mine is past life regression, but I keep finding things no one knows.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about a laboratory that was supposed to be in the mountains.
All underground.
It was in the ground, and they said each person had a part of the formula. So no one knew the entire formula. But it turned out someone made a mistake, and the entire laboratory blew up. So I said, how do we know what was destroyed? And in the mountains, who would have even noticed anything?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you think this is probably true?
That may be true. What we did capture when that section of Germany fell into American hands, by the way, and we backed our trucks into the facilities there and hauled off the documents, we did find two complete bombs in
the underground bunkers.
Carefully secured underground bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was a big bomb, a uranium bomb, and the other one was a longer, more slender bomb that was a plutonium bomb. So the Germans had two atomic bomb projects going simultaneously.
People always think we were the only ones, but this way that means we were both probably developing at the same rate of development.
Were ahead of us because they had theirs ready. Their bombs were all ready to drop, and they had a target date. In the records we found that they had a target date to drop one on New York and one on Washington, D.C. on the 19th of September of 1945.
That was after VE Day, though.
But it was only a very short time after VE Day.
So they were
very ready. Now, at the same time, the German Heinkel factory had built special bombers to make a one-way flight from Norway to the United States to drop these bombs. And then they would go to Cuba if they could. If they couldn't,
that's when the information I got when I was doing the research for my book on Hiroshima was that the bomb was developed to be used against Germany. In the beginning, it was an experiment to find out. But then when the war ended, they said they couldn't drop it, and that was when it was diverted to be dropped on
story associated with that, too. When we found what the bombs were, and we decided to move them to the United States, we sent three bombers to move each bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And all three of the crews were briefed to believe that they had the light real bomb and the others had dummies.
Mm-hmm.
So the crews never knew which bomb was the real one.
You're talking about the German ones now.
Oh, the German ones.
German
when
ones,
we
okay.
brought the German ones from Peenemünde back to Offutt Air Force Base in headquarters SAC.
Okay.
And then they were only there for a week at headquarters SAC before we did the same thing and transported them out to Tinian Island. And a week later, we dropped one on Hiroshima, the plutonium bomb,
mm-hmm.
The uranium bomb on Hiroshima, dropped the plutonium bomb on Nagasaki.
This was something me and Wendell were talking about just before we went on the air. Is it possible that the bomb we dropped on Hiroshima could have been one of the German bombs? Because Wendell thinks there wasn't enough time after the development with the Manhattan Project.
3 weeks.
Yeah, 3 weeks to have got it and then transported it.
Transported and dropped it.
So, it's an interesting theory. Who knows that maybe the bomb we dropped was the one of the Germans?
I'm going to, on a CD I've got, I'm going to give it to you right after the program here.
Okay.
It has pictures of the German bomb, the one that they call the Fat Man, and the picture is identical to the pictures we took of the Fat Boy that we dropped on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't think about that. If they did have to get it to the island in those days, things took a lot longer.
10 days. And we only had 2-3 weeks from the time of our test explosion until we dropped it on Hiroshima.
Yeah. Interesting theory, but then who knows? You know, there's so much of this that was kept secret.
Still kept secret.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a whole lot we'll never know. But that's why you have an inquiring mind. You're like me. You're full of curiosity. You want to know things. But anyway, how did you get into the UFOs then?
Well,
back when you
at that time, we had a mandatory rotational program. We had 2 years in the zone of injury, which is the United States, and 2 years overseas. Mm-hmm. And after 2 years in the zone of injury, you became vulnerable for an overseas assignment. And you would get one within a short time, and then that would be another 2 year period. Then you'd rotate back to the States again. So I was reaching the end of my 2 year ZI, zone of interior assignment, and going to be assigned overseas. And when it came, it was assigned to Alaska, which was considered an overseas base at the time.
Okay.
It was not
a state.
It wasn't
a state
then, it was territory.
Yeah.
And when I got to Alaska, I found that my job there, my additional duty, was to supervise a team of highly technical, highly classified civilians, 6 of them, from my home base at Wright Field, from the Air Technical Intelligence Center, that were installing special equipment aboard the B-29s that were flying their target profile missions on Russia. Remember, every B-29 crew had to fly a simulated bomb drop once a year. And they flew all of the correct legs up to the last change of direction, then they change that back and drop it on a simulated drop on our side of the frontier.
Okay.
So, since that was already funded, and the airplanes were flying, and the crews were being paid, there were piggyback programs that were attached to that requirement. One of them was to look for this anomalous aerial phenomena.
They already knew there was strange things out there.
They knew that, yes. And those B-29s were experiencing an event about twice a month. The airplanes went out every night, sometimes more than once, on their profile missions, and only about 1 out of 15 flights or so had an event to report. Mm-hmm. When they reported the event, the crews returned to Anchorage, Alaska. We separated the crew members, one from each other, put them in separate rooms, and then they were interrogated by experts, and their testimony taken down in shorthand and packaged with the film rolls, the cartridge cassettes, and the rolls of tape and everything from the equipment we put aboard. Now, we put aboard the B-29 surge detectors in each of the electrical systems. There's 5 out of B-29.
Yeah.
We put radio frequency detectors that would read the entire radio frequency spectrum, scan it, stop on the strongest signal, record it for 30 seconds, then cancel it, scan again for the next strongest, 30 seconds, cancel that till they covered them all, then it would start over, do it again for the whole 14-hour flight.
So they knew when something was out of the ordinary.
We also put magnetic detectors aboard the airplane to measure ambient changes in the magnetic field. We put thermal detectors to look for changes in ambient temperature in the airplanes. All those things were recorded at one time or another. More cameras to take the pictures, opportunity cameras. There's a camera in every gun position on the B-29 already. We gave them 4x5 press cameras, 35mm hand cameras. All this was part of the kit of equipment that went aboard each B-29 every night they went out on target profile missions.
Mm-hmm. So this started your interest in the UFOs.
I wasn't allowed
then
to possess anything that came back. It was all packaged in a metal locker, chained to an officer's wrist, and flown to Washington that night. And what didn't go to Washington had to be shredded and burned that same day, destroyed. So
this
I never
shows
got to see
that
it.
Washington has had information for a long time.
And you know, an interesting thing, and that my superiors thought that we were looking for a Russian development, and I was convinced that it was extraterrestrial, truly extraterrestrial visitation. From what I was looking at, it looked extraterrestrial.
Hmm.
And I couldn't persuade my superiors that it was extraterrestrial. They kept insinuating that they thought it was a Russian development. From the Air Technical Intelligence Center's work, I couldn't see how the Russians could have succeeded in making that big a jump in aviation technology. And
yeah.
So I didn't accept their idea. But now, after years of research on the German disk, I find that when the war ended, when the Russians drove the Germans back into Germany. They crossed the frontier between Russia and Poland before the Germans successfully evacuated all the Kugelblitz research bases, those nine symbols on the map. The Russians captured one intact with all the staff, with the work in progress, all the machinery, and the families that lived there. They lived underground with the project working. Mm. And they took the whole thing up in the northern Siberia to Lake Tymyr, T-Y-M-Y-R,
okay.
where they reorganized it, set the whole thing back up there in 1945. So they could have been building some of these vehicles that we were photographing or experiencing contact with on our profile missions. And I had no idea that that was going on at the time.
But the only way was because they were able to reconstruct. They had the scientists there.
They had everything to continue the German program just as it was. And in 1941, the Germans were successfully flying these discs, the first Hannibals.
There's a lot people don't know.
Oh,
but you know, it gets to the point that, you know, I don't believe anything coming out of Washington anymore. I tell people, think for themselves.
Yeah.
That there is so much they don't know about. But,
or that we're kept from knowing about.
Yeah, I know. But your interest has, you've kept up with the UFO field all these years.
Yeah. Yeah, I just published a report on the Nazi flying disc. It's 300 pages. Mm. It has over 100 photographs of the German discs, many of them in flight. Mm. Diagrams, pictures of craft in development, and there was a young man, a computer expert, you call him a computer nerd today.
He lived
up in the Chicago area that was continually trying to break into black budget projects. He finally broke into one that involved the German disc research and the development of the Hannibal series of craft. And in searching those records, he found that we brought some back to the United States at the end of the war that were unfinished, and we successfully finished some of them out in the White Sands Missile Test Area, where they had set up a special project for this. And we had continued the development, and he discovered some research test sites that they were being tested at, and he walked and calculated a date for a test and drove out there and staked it out. And he succeeded in getting pictures of one of our later developments.
Yeah.
And then he got another test site. Then he picked up a third, then a fourth, then a fifth. And he got a series of photographs of our later developments of the captured technology that we got from Germany.
Hmm.
And those are in the disc.
And, you know, we know with the UFO field, I've been involved with it for over 20 years, that they keep telling us, oh, there's nothing to it, you know, and they try to make everybody appear like they're crazy.
Yeah.
But we know when we've been involved with it so long, there is a lot to it, and we keep finding out more, and you seem to be right in the middle of all of this. But is there one case that you've investigated that you think is your most important or the most interesting, or are there many?
Well,
one
that stands out in my mind is, first the Pleiades case, but that's pretty well known now, was a case of contact from Reticulum, where it all began with a born-again Christian that would have laughed at anybody trying to tell him a UFO story. He wouldn't read the reports in the newspaper, didn't collect any magazines. If anybody showed him a picture, he'd laugh it away.
Is he in the States, or where was he?
He was living in South Carolina, North Charleston, South Carolina.
The Deep South, okay.
In the Bible Belt, where they don't even allow movie theaters to open on Sunday,
okay.
Blue Laws country.
So he's a real dyed-in-the-wool.
Oh, yeah,
okay.
And a real born-again Christian and a very religious man. His family attended church regularly, three or four times a week, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was a deacon in his church. He passed the collection plate. He taught the Sunday school. He helped keep the church records. So he was pretty high in the order in the church hierarchy in his town there.
Okay.
Southern Baptist Conference Church. So after his contact, he saw a pinkish-orange light in the sky that kept coming closer. And then he thought it was paying attention to him, and then one night, and it was flying a strange pattern. It was sharp, a pattern with sharp angular turns, changes of direction like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was easily recognized because of its flight path. No airplane can fly that way. So a neighbor lady came to his little house trailer, to borrow a cup of sugar one night, and his wife saw the the craft out there flying these strange triangular patterns. She says, Bill, well, your friend is out here. He went out and looked over his wife's and the neighbor's head that saw it, and he says, I think I'll go out there and see if I can get a better, closer look at it. Uh-huh. So he put on his jacket, put a binoculars over his shoulder, and went out into the night, to about 9 o'clock at night, to get closer to it. And he walked across the ditch and up on the railroad track that ran above the trailer park there. And he was standing on the railroad track watching it through the binoculars and trying to focus on it because it was moving so erratically it was hard to keep it in view.
Yeah.
And then he saw it drop like a stone. And he saw it dropped into the Ashley River. And he's trying to focus the binoculars to see where it splashed in the river. And as he was doing that, it swooped in and filled the sky in front of him like that. So close and so fast, he thought it was going to knock him down. So he shied back like that, caught his foot on the rail, began to fall. And he didn't fall. He put his hand down to catch the jagged rocks along the railroad track.
Yeah.
And he never hit the rocks. He didn't feel them at all. And he saw tall grass blowing away from him in waves. Then he looked up and he's in a beam of blue light going up into the air with a kind of an electrical tugging like that.
Yeah.
And when he reached the bottom of the craft, he fainted, woke up on an examining table aboard.
I've heard of the blue light. I know about these things. But how did he explain all of this?
Well,
the light in the sky.
Yeah, he couldn't explain. He thought that it was a Navy vehicle and air vehicle under test, and he kept calling the Navy and telling them because they had their naval storage facilities. He kept calling them and telling them your test vehicle is easily seen. If you got a secret project going, everybody can see it, and you ought to be more careful about this.
Okay, because I was wondering if he didn't believe in this and he saw this erratic.
He thought it was either an Air Force or a Navy test, and he kept calling to tell them that everybody could see it. They should be more covert about the operation. He kept telling them they didn't have any tests going on, but he didn't believe it because they're not going to tell them anyway if there was.
Yeah.
Finally, he went out to the airbase there and he took pictures of it to show them the pictures. They were real interested in the pictures, but they told him they didn't have any tests going on. They wanted to leave the pictures. He said, I'll tell you what, I'll leave you one. But I'm going to keep the rest.
Yeah, I'm thinking, don't give away your negative.
Yeah.
Don't give away your only copy.
Right.
Uh-huh.
So that's how that began. And the contact, that night, he was picked up just a few yards from his trailer home, and he was let after being examined on an exam. He woke up on an examining table with a bar of lights above him slowly. They were changing like real fast, like running lights.
Uh-huh.
And they flowed down until they stopped, and he's looked around, and he's full conscious by then, and he saw four little beings standing around the table.
Yeah.
And his first reaction was to scream for his wife,
uh-huh,
because they looked like overgrown fetuses, and he saw he's gone to hell or something like that.
What he was like.
he said, who are they? And he's trying to figure that out when the one nearest him came over, touched him on the shoulder to help him set up. He sat up on the edge of the examining table with his legs dangling off, and he touched him again to get off the table, and he's standing up, but the three of them around him, and none of them comes as high as his shoulder,
uh-huh,
like kids. And they motioned for him to follow, and then he heard his name. They said, Bill, follow us. And he followed the leader that walked them towards the door in the wall. They all that went through the door, two of them, him and two of them, the other two stayed in the examining room. And they went in one door, and there was a pause, then they went out another door, and they were in a bigger part of the ship with more of those creatures working, doing different things.
Mm-hmm.
And the main one that would contact him spoke English very clearly.
He spoke or used that word as mind to mind.
In his case, he thought of telepathy too, but he was hearing it physically in his ears, and he said that he heard it like surround sound. He was sure it wasn't mental.
Okay.
And it was like stereo surround sound. And he asked him about it, and the voice said that it was a device that it called itself a lexicon, whatever that means, and then some kind of a master computer.
Hmm.
And the lexicon was something receiving his transmissions and converting them to the alien language form, and the aliens would respond, and it would convert it back to his familiar English form.
Something electronic, then.
Yeah, so
I think it's possible, because I've worked on this.
Yeah, there was two-way communication, very coherent two-way communication, and he'd ask questions about the ship, and they would explain very carefully. They showed him the navigation room with the navigation instruments and devices, and a navigation table with moving sheets with moving symbols on them. They showed him the power room and the power unit. They showed him the control unit. They let him sit down at a control console, one of the one-legged stools there. Showed him how to use the controls to zoom in and out on the pictures. They were looking at a car on the road. They were down over Florida at this time. They showed him a car, two cars run on the road below, running on the road. And his mentor reached over, touched him on the shoulder and said, "Watch." And he reached up and did something on the control panel. The car stopped. A woman jumped out of the front one and stood beside the car looking up, and two men in the back. When the driver jumped out, the second man in the second car was laying down in the back seat. He rolled down the back window and stuck his head out. They're all looking up with their mouths open. Like they're very surprised. And then he touched him on the shoulder again, and he says, "Now watch what happens." And he did something else, evidently brightened the light, because the woman's mouth got bigger, and she threw her hands in the air and ran around and jerked the car over and jumped in and pushed down the lock on both sides. And he said a futile gesture if we wanted to do anything.
Oh, yeah, because I've heard they get in the car. They don't have to do
so anything. So the one in the back seat, he went into a fetal ball like that, scared to death. The other one jumped in the car, and they all put him in gear, started racing down the road. And the alien turned off the screens, and they went up over Cape Canaveral, which is not too far away.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed him the hangar where we were working on the space shuttle. And then the alien did something and dissolved the roof of the hangar so that they could see through it. Like,
they told me that they can see through things.
Yeah, and it was just like there was no
inside
roof there.
Inside the houses, inside anything you want. You know?
And he watched the workman working on the shuttle, and the alien touched him again on the shoulder and said, "You should contact him and tell him there are some loose tiles under the nose that can be very serious."
Mm.
So he went to considerable pains and time to crawl and get somebody down there and tell them they got some loose tiles. They kind of laughed at him.
They would
but that
them.
Ship came back after the launch with three tiles missing on the nose.
Ah.
That could have burned the ship up coming back in.
You know, now we know the Challenger and these different things. It's very possible.
Yeah.
But is this story in one of the books you have written?
Yeah, it's in UFO Contact from Reticulum.
Okay. How many books have you written? I know some of them are out of print. But
I think there's 18 hardbacks and 31 e-books, electronic books.
Yes, you said now you're going into e-books instead of the...
Yeah, and you got too expensive to publish the hardbacks anymore. You can't publish less than 1,000. If you publish more than 1,000, you can't afford that either.
But you have 18 books that you've written over your career dealing with the cases you've investigated. Is that
you know, I didn't write any of them because I can't sit down and write a letter. I can't write my mother. All through the war, I couldn't write my mother. If I sit down to write something for myself, it just doesn't come out right, and I scrap it, throw it away, and give up. But when an idea comes in the right side of my head here somehow and goes out through my fingers, it just keeps going until it reaches a point where it stops, and I can't add anything to it. At that point, I just put it aside. Later, I'll be led back to it, and it starts up right where I left off, and it does some more.
Well, that's what happens to me. I sit down and write, and I don't know where it comes from, and I just
or where it's going, but it keeps going.
I keep writing and writing, and then a little later, I'll go back and look at it, and I said, "It's pretty good. Where'd that come from?"
Exactly, and I think, "God, did I write that?"
Well, they always say that's the creative process.
Well, I think it's my spirit guide is doing the creating, because
I
can't do it without him.
But that's, you know, the old days, they used to call it the muses.
Yeah.
You know, my muses have just deserted me. But it's supposed to be the creative process that, where does it come from?
Yeah.
And I just sit down and do it.
The research comes the same way. I couldn't sit down and do a research project on by myself because I just get lost in the minutiae. But when there's, while doing the research that they're guiding, they lead me right to the evidence that I want, like that. So all I have to do is collect it, pile it up, and then start sorting.
I love research.
Yeah.
I like to spend all day in the university library looking for one little grain of information. Most people would think that'd be boring, but to find that one little
piece. Do you find when you're doing that, and you haven't succeeded, and you're puzzling, you say, "Now, where will I look next?" And you're walking down the aisle, and the book falls out on your floor in front of you. The very book you were looking for has the information that you wanted.
Right there. or there'll be a person that I need to contact.
Thing that I've had is the back of the book lights up. All the other books are normal. The back of that book lights up, and I think, why is that book brighter? And I take it out and look at it. That's what it looks like.
Well, people tell me all the time they're in bookstores that my books will fall off the shelf and hit them in the head. And they say, well, I guess I better get that book.
That's always puzzled me.
Oh, okay. Well, there was something we were talking about, and it might be interesting to go into. I don't know if you had enough experience about it, but we were talking about crashes, you know, the UFO crashes, that the government has recovered the debris and also the aliens from them. Mm-hmm. And I know I've been to Roswell, I've spoken in Roswell, and I've told them out there that is not the only case. There is. People think that was the only one. Mm-hmm. But I investigated one that occurred in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And I've had to keep it secret because the man who mm-hmm. told me had retired from the military. Mm-hmm. And he showed me his discharge papers. I mm-hmm. believe that this all had a very powerful effect on him.
Mm-hmm.
But with his, he was with the helicopter crew. Mm-hmm. And they were sent out for crashed aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought this was a crashed aircraft. Instead, mm-hmm. it was a UFO that had crashed. And so they landed, and it had split open. And so they got out of the helicopter, him and the other soldiers, and looked in there, and there were bodies in there.
Live ones?
There were bodies.
Yeah, any live ones?
I don't know. He said all they could see was bodies, and they saw clear fluid, which leads me to believe it's true, because it wasn't like blood. It was like clear fluid. And he just, that's as much as they saw when another helicopter landed and had officers in it. And they came over and told them, you get on back on that helicopter and get back to the base, and we'll talk to you when you get back there. Mm-hmm. So they never got to see any more than that. Mm-hmm. But when they got back to the base, they said they separated all of them.
Everyone.
And they interrogated them for 24 hours, brainwashing. You did not see what you mm-hmm. thought you
mm-hmm.
saw.
Yeah.
You made it up, you know, it mm-hmm. didn't exist, and went on and on like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said they were all transferred to different bases so they would never have contact, and they threatened them, if you ever say anything about this, we'll come after you and kill your family.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the reasons they came to me, because he was having all these nightmares. He was out of the service, but I guess it was what he saw and also the threats by the government.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe these things are true.
Yeah.
That they are happening.
Mm-hmm.
And there's more than people think. But, you know, in my work, I found they said normally, you know, when I say they, because I communicate with them in my work, they said normally they're very good pilots and they don't have crashes. But they said if it has to do with an electrical storm
mm-hmm.
or a bad thunderstorm, it interferes with the energy field around the craft and the mechanisms, and they can crash. It has to do with some kind of an electrical disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
And in Roswell, they said it did happen in the thunderstorm.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know about the one in Kentucky, but I would like to mention a letter that I just received when I got back from Europe.
Yeah.
I'm not going to mention the man's name, but he is worried because he's afraid if the government finds out he knows about this, are they in danger? I want to know what you think.
I would say that he is, yes.
Yes, but this one, he said, happened in North Carolina. And he said, he's an investigator. Well, maybe I shouldn't go any further than that. I don't want to identify him.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to get the poor man in trouble. But he said he didn't want to communicate by telephone or email because
mm-hmm.
he's worried.
Smart.
Anyway, he says that on October the 20th, 2003.
Oh, a recent one.
Recent one in Newland, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
That two UFO crashes within 5 minutes of each other.
Wow, that's an interesting story.
And then several months later, a third crash occurred in the same area. Now, he doesn't go into whether there were storms or what was
mm-hmm.
going on.
Mm-hmm.
But the evidence came through many witnesses. So a lot of them went out and they began looking over the area looking
mm-hmm.
for debris.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that after that, they didn't find anything. I don't know if he did or not, but he said after that, the people who lived up there said there were black helicopters all over the area.
Okay, so we recovered the residue. Apparently, and then sanitized the area so there's nothing left. It didn't look like it was disturbed.
Apparently, they knew they were out there looking, and they wanted to make sure they've got everything. Mm-hmm. But he seems to think, he said he thought they were picked up by satellite, that they saw them out there. That was how they knew they were there. This is guessing. Mm-hmm. But he's thinking maybe they didn't get it all, and that's what they went back to make sure, oh, there wasn't anything left. Of course, he would like to follow up on all this, but he's worried about the government.
Yeah, the standard procedure is to go back and sanitize the area. That means pick up every scrap of evidence and then rearrange the grass and the rocks and rake the ground so that it looks like it did before the event happened and leaves no trace left for anybody to find.
But you know, in Roswell, they did find pieces, but that was in the early days before they knew how to really go over the area.
Yeah.
But this is in North Carolina, 2003. That's pretty recent.
They've got a lot of experience in sanitizing an area after that.
Do you have any advice for this man? Should he? He's worried about going public.
Well, it would be dangerous to go public with the information because it probably has not been released anyplace and is carefully controlled by whoever picked up the remains. Mm-hmm. You know, Leonard Stringfield spent a lifetime collecting information on crashes. He had recorded 37 of them. But it did not include the one you just mentioned. Of course, he died before that one happened. So,
what about, did he hear about anything in Kentucky in the 1970s? That was
in
the
Kentucky
one.
In the 70s, there was one that crashed, that landed on a runway at an air base.
Was it in Kentucky?
And an occupant got out, and somebody chased it. The occupant didn't get back in time, and in it in time when it left. Left him on the runway, and the air police shot him and killed him.
Hmm. Because I've heard that there are still some being held that are alive.
Oh, yes. We got live ones out of a number of cases. There was a crash north of Kingman, Arizona in 1953,
mm-hmm.
8 miles north of Kingman. And that vehicle came down relatively intact. It was not damaged. It had 4 live occupants in it. It couldn't take back off again. And the conjecture was that its control system was damaged somehow by radar.
By radar?
By radar.
Because they said storms,
anything
to disturb the electrical field.
Well, this one was apparently damaged by radar because they were able to repair it later.
Okay.
And the live occupants, the Army got on the scene, they closed the highways and the access roads to it, and they successfully recovered it intact, complete, and the live occupants were all put in a van and carried to Los Alamos, where they had already prepared a habitat of sorts, so they could control the atmosphere and a number of things. And they evidently had gotten live occupants before because somebody had prepared a habitat.
So they knew how to.
They knew how to prepare it, and they took them to Los Alamos, where they put them in the habitat, and the recovery crews from Area 51 picked up the craft on a tank hauler, a big lowboy that carries damaged battle tanks. And they couldn't tip it because it wouldn't allow itself to be tipped. They could raise it and lower it, picking it up, but they couldn't tilt it.
Yeah.
So they weren't able to rig it on the lowboy in any position where they could take it down a road or a highway. It was 30 feet in diameter also. So
you would have to close off all these highways.
Yeah. So what they did is they took it cross-country, off-road, going over railroads and across creeks, and they take down the power lines and the fences and then repair them behind it as it went.
Yeah.
And took it into Area 51. When they got it to Area 51, my friend, who was the simulator expert, was one of the engineers that was called in to try to stop it from making a noise. It was making a humming noise.
Oh.
And after 2 weeks of engineers trying to get in and stop the humming noise, they could get inside, but they couldn't stop the noise.
Uh-huh.
Finally, one of them suggested, let's get the occupants to come back and turn the noise off. So they did. They drove them back from Los Alamos to Area 51 with gestures. They indicated what they wanted them to do. They indicated they'd have to go aboard to do it. So they allowed
them. They could have taken off.
Yeah, they thought of that, too. So they sent a guard in aboard with them, and they all got, the four got inside and the guard behind them, and the guard came out right immediately, retching and throwing up on the ground. He wouldn't go back in. They tried to send another man and he wouldn't go in either. So the occupants are inside all by themselves.
I wonder what was making them sick.
Don't know. So about, they were in there about 4 minutes and they were, the engineers were concerned about him trying to get it ready to take off again.
Yeah.
When the occupants appeared at the door, they stopped the noise, then came back to the door again, stood there and waited to be loaded back in the carry-all, taken back to Los Alamos.
Hmm.
As it turns out, those occupants had all, before they made contact with us, had already learned to communicate with us. They could talk to our handlers in English. One of them, at least, was quite fluent in English. The other,
rudimentary. Mind to mind. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this one could articulate the language, and in Los Alamos, they, knowing that they could communicate with them, and they allowed the entities to bring a module from the craft back to Los Alamos, but it is indicated they could contact their home society with.
Okay.
So we persuaded them to get in touch with their home society, and we would like to negotiate with them. And that turns out to be the beginning of the Circle cases, because those entities made contact with their superiors who wanted to recover bodies from another earlier crash that the government agreed to return. And the aliens offered to send a couple of their scientists to Area 51 to help them try to understand the craft that they had recovered, the technology and the craft they had recovered. So our idea was to let's get it. We'll put some scientists with them, learn to bridge the gap between their technology and ours, build our own.
Yeah.
But the problem came when after 15 years of working on this, they had failed to bridge any gap. They still didn't even know how to turn them on and operate them. And the aliens kept explaining to them that it requires a certain amount of mental input to make the systems operate. And we never learned that mental input, so we never got any place.
See, that's the information I have, is that it's operated by thought.
By thought, by, yep.
And it can be one individual or a whole group.
Or a group
board,
together, yeah.
And that there are crystals that store this energy, and it's all done by thought. Well, naturally, we're not developed enough to do that.
We never succeeded.
We think we could do these things.
But this meeting was in 1968 at Los Alamos, chaired by Edward Teller, the head of the Los Alamos complex.
Because he was
also
one of the ones that
he was at the table with the alien on one side, the engineer on another, and 15 other scientists around there. They agreed that they are not able, they haven't made any progress in 15 years. We haven't been able to learn the first item on the craft. And the aliens are trying to explain it's because we don't have the mental input to do so.
But I know Dr. Edward Teller is one of the ones that helped develop the atomic bomb, too.
Yes.
So he was involved with all of this then.
Yeah, he was the head of the Atomic Energy Commission, which had the most secure area in the world, which is where Area 51 is. So all of the atomic reservation out there was under Edward Teller. And his headquarters was at Los Alamos, where we built the habitat. So we obviously knew that there were going to be more, or expected there to be more, such crashes. All the crashes were taken to the Atomic Energy Commission, AEC, storage area, because it was the most secure area we had in the country.
Well, some of the information I've been getting is that some of these EVTs are separated. They're put in little rooms by themselves instead of letting them...
We have more than one group now, yeah. In fact, we have about half a dozen live aliens that are from different places and they're different kinds. They require
different...
But there's
been others that have died, too.
Several have died, yeah.
That's what information I had.
We have one that's ill now, being treated for a neurological disorder.
But what I've heard is they were separated, and maybe they didn't want them to be together?
Well, the ones that came from the same place are not separated. They're together.
Okay.
The ones that from different origins are in different habitats.
Okay. Because I was thinking separating them would cause them to, where they'll die, too,
yeah,
because
yeah.
they don't have... Everything needs contact with its own kind.
Yeah, and there's an interesting story about the one in the clean sphere out at Area 51. When a doctor was brought in to treat the neurological disorder, that would speak English, by the way. He learned our language before he made contact here.
Yeah.
And the doctor explained that he was going to have to take a blood specimen to analyze the problem. And the alien is telling him what the neurological disorder is, how to try to treat it, and he held his arm up for him to take the blood specimen.
Yeah.
And he was in a clean sphere, kept in a clean sphere. It was a plastic bubble.
And
the doctor said that the alien kept asking me, he'd say, can you get me some clothes? You people all have clothes and I'm kept here naked. Why can't I have clothes too? I thought, it's terrible. We keep the alien locked up, imprisoned, and naked when he's not accustomed to that. That's not part of his society. And he's been there for years like that. Mm. Isn't that terrible? Why can't we get him clothes?
The information I've got is that they don't care. They just want to study them. They don't really
our
care what happens.
Care. They don't care how he feels or how comfortable he is.
No, they don't worry about those things. But I believe these things are true because, you know, I'm like you. I have so many emails and letters that people send me, and there's a lot more going on than we even suspect.
Oh, yeah. It's a shame how much we're kept in the dark about what's going on. Mm-hmm. Really going on.
But I'm watching the clock here because we have to stop it a little bit. But part of the thing that I got, though, was these little grays are not the most important ones. The most important ones are on the mothership.
Mm-hmm.
And that these little grays, they said, I called them robots, and they said, it's not a robot as you think it's a robot. Mm-hmm. They are biologically created entities to do the work.
Created for a specific task.
Yes, and they're sent in the small craft.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, you'll see more of the small craft with the little ones than you will ever see the others. A lot of it has to do with the density and the pressure of our atmosphere, and the ones on the mothercraft can't take that.
Yes.
It's very hard on their body. Mm-hmm. These are engineered to take the pressure and the density.
And they're also expendable.
Because they are just like little, we call them gophers, you know, the ones who just do the work.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're the ones that come and get the samples, pick up the specimens, and take them back to the mothercraft for examination. And that's what I've found. And I believe it's true.
Well, I think it is. That those are the ones that picked Enrique Castillo Rincon up and took him out to a mothership down in Bogota, Colombia.
Mm-hmm. So the majority of the ones that the government is picking up are not the intelligent ones.
Yeah.
They're not the ones that run the laboratories. These are just the little guys. But they have been biologically created. And the larger ones, they have some that are 7 foot tall that look like these grays.
Yeah, that are not.
Which would make sense if we're ever going to make a robot, we'll probably make them in our image, a little human running around. But so I've been doing this 20 years, and I think a lot of the information I've received is accurate, too.
Probably more accurate than anything the government is releasing.
Oh, yeah, because that's what I've been told. They don't want to work for the government anymore because the government has not stood up to its end of the bargain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I'm watching the clock, and we have to stop now. This is fascinating, and I would like it if maybe you could do it again with me by phone.
Sometime,
because you never know. I'm going to be doing a lot of interviews, but this one has been at the 18th UFO conference here in the end of the Ozarks in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. And there are many more people here that I could interview, but I wanted to do Wendell because I've known him for so many years. And you have a wealth of information.
Been a long time. I've been at this for 60 years.
You've been accumulated a lot. So I want to thank you for doing the interview tonight.
You bet.
Okay.
Thank you, Dolores.
And thank you.